This week's Fiber Talk podcast with Claire Hunter is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America and Sassy Jack's Stitchery. One of the things to read regularly is the EGA blog. It's available to members and non-members. Recent posts include a video of the EGA semi-annual meeting, which gives you a chance to learn more about the many facets of the Embroiderers Guild of America, information about registering for Broadway Bound, the EGA National Seminar in New York City, a beautiful Hardanger Trio online class with Kim Beamish, Golden Blooms, the March Stitch Along that celebrates Women's History Month, and what EGA members are stitching to show support for Ukrainian people. If you're a member, the blog is a way to keep up with the EGA activities. If you're not a member, it gives you a good idea of the value of EGA membership. If you're not a member, please consider joining through a local chapter or as a member at large. All of the information is available at egausa.org. Also sponsoring this week's show is Sassy Jack's Stitchery, home of Sassafras samplers. In 2022, the folks at Sassy Jack's are planning to release a Sassafras sampler chart each month. To see many of the upcoming samplers, watch the March 9 Fiber Talk Stitch Hour, in which Kim Young and Susan Greening Davis tell us about those samplers and many others. As we await the opening of the new Sassy Jack's store in a couple of months, visit sassyjackstitchery.com for all of your needlework needs and to sign up for several live classes and workshops that will be offered in the coming months. Things are ramping up rapidly at Sassy Jack's, and it will pay to keep up by visiting sassyjackstitchery.com or the Sassy Jack's Facebook page. Thanks to EGA and Sassy Jack's for sponsoring the show, and now on to our conversation with Claire Hunter. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, returning after almost 3 years now, Claire Hunter. Claire, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Beth.
So good to talk to you again. Now, for those who don't know Claire, she's a needleworker. But she's also an author, an excellent author, and we talked to her two shows back-to-back in November 2019. You can go back and listen to those. One, we talked about Claire's needlework activities, which is fascinating in its own right, but then also her first book, Threads of Life, A History of the World Through the Eye of a Needle. And so one show was about the book, one show about Claire and her needlework career. And we were just talking here before we recorded. Read that book. Go read that book. It is excellent. And several awards for that. Claire, really, congratulations. That really is a terrific book to get recognized. Saltire, was it Saltire First Book Award?
Saltire First Book Award. Yeah. Thank you for kind words, Gary.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. So go read that book. But now, When we talked to Claire in 2019, she mentioned that her next book was going to be about Mary Queen of Scots. Well, she did it. She wrote it. So she's back now because you're listening to this on March 20. On the 17th, her new book, Embroidering Her Truth, Mary Queen of Scots and the Language of Power, was released on March 17. So you can get that now where all good books are sold. Beth and I have read this book, and go get this book too. Buy both of them. Just get a package and get both of them, and you'll be happy.
Yes.
That's our recommendation.
There you go.
All right. And with that, Claire, it was great to talk to you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you for the plug.
All right. So the first question, you know, if you go right to the back of your book and look at the list of references and all of the publications about Mary Queen of Scots, it is two truckloads. So then why for you a book, an extensive book, just a really thorough job, why a book about Mary Queen of Scots when so much has been done?
Well, when I was writing Threads of Life, I actually had Mary as a central figure in chapter 3, which was about power.
Yes.
And when I was researching that, I then discovered that there were all these inventories and treasurer's accounts. In a sense, the treasurer's accounts were like her kind of Amazon purchase list, you know, of the fabrics and threads that she bought through time in her reign in Scotland. And I just thought, this is a whole range of material that I didn't even know existed. And I became fascinated by the fact that actually there was a material culture, particularly amongst women, that hadn't really been investigated. And I thought Mary would be the ideal person to basically excavate another story about her, but also other women's agency in the 16th century. And so I started to research, and of course, as is always the way, once you start to research, you discover more and more and more. And right. And so the book became this kind of unraveling of hopefully an alternative biography of Mary that hadn't been written. And as you say, there's so many books written about her, I thought, is there space for another one? But I became convinced that hopefully my book would give an alternative biography that would be useful.
Yeah, I couldn't help but wonder as reading the book, I couldn't help but wonder how many times you changed course while doing the research. Did you have a kind of a rough plan to begin with and then shift back and forth as you learn more?
Absolutely, Gary. What obviously you start with is a plan that you think is watertight. and then you start to, you carry on researching and you start to write and you discover that your watertight plan is not going to work. You've got to find another way through. And so you start moving your jigsaw of your information around. Obviously, I wanted the book to be chronological so that people didn't get lost in time, that they could know where they were in Mary's life. But at the same time, I had to find themes that would fit in with that particular stage of her life. So in the chapters are headed with a name of a textile that was part of her world at that time. So it goes through costume, it goes through clothes, it goes through religious textiles, different kinds of textiles, real textiles that were part of her life. And that gave me another kind of framework on which to explore particular aspects of her material world and the world of other women.
And I love your style with each chapter starting out with a story about you and your personal experience as you go through this. And then transitioning over to the history and Mary, and it adds such a personal present day connection.
Well, I think the thing, Gary, is that it has to be said that in Mary's life, there aren't many laughs.
And yes,
she had, she had in the main a pretty dismal time of it, and for readers to just read such tragedy page after page after, it's not possible. It becomes too dense. It becomes too unrelaxing. So I needed to kind of lighten the tone from time to time in order to pace the book in a different way. And of course, using memoir allowed me to do that because my own stories, most of them, while not laugh aloud, are at least light relief.
Yeah, compared to Mary's life, yes. Of course, that's a pretty low bar in terms of light relief when you use Mary.
Exactly, poor soul.
Oh, no kidding. What a life. Ouch. And now the research you did for this, obviously extensive. I mean, it's not hard to tell just reading the book, but you get to the back and you really see extensive research, reading, I can't even imagine things. But then also having to do it during a pandemic really add an extra challenge to this thing, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. It was just, basically I had no access to records office, to archives, to places that I wanted to visit, to all sorts of material that I had hoped would become a treasure trove of discovery. And so I had to find alternative means. One was, luckily, some of the things like the treasurer's accounts, some of those are now printed as facsimile copies, which I could get from India. Digitalization is, of course, a kind of bounty for a researcher, because I could get online some of, again, the older documents that I needed to view and read. The difficulty there was that because you're looking at it on your screen, then every time you turned a page, you had to, the font's very small, so you'd have to enlarge the font, but every time you turned a page, you had to then decrease it again before you turned to the next page. And we're talking about state papers that were 700 pages long, each one. And it was the time, the labour, the tediousness of it, because I didn't know what I might find. So I had to just continue page by page, seeing if there was something, some nugget of information that hadn't as yet been, out there in the world.
Right.
And so it was tedious. That said, given that we were in lockdown, given that we, were in a sense imprisoned in our own house, then I didn't have much else to do. So luckily for me, I could spend that time. There were some fantastic academic books written about Renaissance textiles, about costume of the time, but they were very, very, very expensive. And I didn't know if that particular volume might have a paragraph or three chapters that were relevant to me, because I couldn't go to a library and look at it. So I had to then second guess, and I did spend large amounts of money, it has to be said, on books. Luckily for me, a lot of them secondhand. And our postie here, because we live in a small remote glen in Scotland, our postie did sterling work carrying up books after books after books. And I accumulated over 150 during that time on Mary. Which I'm hoping to give to the University of Stirling as a collection itself.
Yeah.
But it was the only way of doing it.
Postman gets home at night. I don't know what that woman's doing, but jeez.
He is thanked my acknowledgements in the book, which I think is totally the right thing to do.
Yes. One thing I noticed in the writings is that at one point you took a handwriting class. And I was most fascinated by that, because I can see how that would be a huge tool to have when you're looking at historical documents.
Absolutely. So I did one day a week for 6 weeks, paleotography course, as it's called, the study of old handwriting, with a very stern tutor. We were about six of us, and basically we were given homework each week with what began always as a completely indecipherable document. And then with a magnifying glass, eventually I moved on to having a magnifying glass with a light inbuilt into it. Then you just painstakingly had to go through each word, trying to find a way to get to know that particular person's handwriting. Because each person, of course, is idiosyncratic. They all have their own ways of using abbreviations, of using language. And in those days, because paper was expensive, then they cram up the words as close together as they can. And also it was a precaution against people inserting other material, because, in the day of when forgery was rampant, then, basically people could not risk their text being interfered with. So again, that was another reason why they kind of crowded it in together so that nobody could insert other words. So the whole kind of challenge of trying to read those documents, I spent a kind of fruitless 3 hours before lockdown in the National Library in London, looking at some of the documents of Mary's time and despairing that I would ever, and that was after I'd done my course, that I would ever be able to read them properly. Luckily for me, lots of other people in earlier times had transposed and transcribed some of those documents into print, so I was saved some of the battle.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. When I look at my handwriting, I can't imagine anyone ever deciphering it. So, yes. Did that play a major role in helping you, or because of what others had done, did it really become just a nice thing to have when you got in a pinch?
Well, the thing I think that was hard for me was obviously I was trying to find things that hadn't necessarily been written about or hadn't been transposed yet, because particularly in earlier times, it was largely male historians or biographers who were transcribing these things, and they weren't necessarily interested in Mary's needlework or women's culture. So they would maybe not translate that particular letter because it just seemed like women's stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously in Mary's correspondence, the bulk of her correspondence, she wrote in French. So while I did French at school to a limited degree, and I also, for my sins, did Latin, then again, I had to resort to older French dictionaries to try and get me through some of the material.
Oh, my, French, and then you have to go to old French. Oh, jeez.
Absolutely, it was old French. Cotgrave's French dictionary was my godsend, you know, and also with inventories, etc., that were made at the Scottish court, then they're in older Scots.
Yes.
And particularly for textile terms, they were generally, because textiles were imported, then they were often described in the language where they had of their provenance. So that might be, again, in French, or it might be in Spanish, or it might be in Italian. And so you were dealing with this kind of myriad languages on a page that you had to try and work out the exact meaning of that.
And then they don't spell everything the same every single time.
Well, spelling was actually, you know, almost unimportant in the 16th century, because basically in the main, the documents they were writing were just as records. So they weren't, or maybe correspondence, but everybody expected people's spelling to be erratic, and so it proved, you know.
The page, it's right up front where you describe the different kinds of measurements.
Oh, yes.
And before I even read the book, I just sat there for a moment and I thought, okay, 15th, 16th century measurements and quantities and all of those things. And I just had a moment of thinking what you had to go through just to get that so you could translate it into modern terms so that people could understand. Almost like working with the Bible.
That's right, because you want people to be able to appreciate how much yardage that is. But then you're talking in ells, which was the kind of measurement they used in those days, but you had different widths according to, or different lengths according to whether it was a French ell or a Scottish ell or an English ell or a Flemish ell. And then in terms of the actual kind of quantities, then the quantities are all written in the treasurer's accounts in Roman numerals, as is all the money. And the money was a total nightmare, because it would have been lovely to have been able to say with any certainty that, you know, Mary spent this much thousands of pounds on whatever. But actually, in mid-16th century, there was constant inflation and deflation of currencies. There was new currencies coming online. You know, the French had francs, they had crowns, they had different kinds of currency. And also because of the Scots pound was not the same value as the English sterling. So sometimes something might have been bought from England and that might be noted down in English sterling, or it might be noted down in Scots pounds. Originally in the book, I had more calculations than I use. There was an online kind of old money calculator app that you could use, but it wasn't totally reliable, I felt. And so I only a couple of times in the book did I allow myself to give an equivalent today, because to go further than that would be to lead me down the path of possibly misinformation, which I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
But it was very tempting to grasp onto, you know, what something would be worth. You know, and of course, again, in those days, compared to today, fabric itself was worth so much more than it is now, because it was being hand-dyed, hand-woven, usually, you know, coming imported from other countries like Italy, particularly for velvets. And you didn't just have one velvet like we would know today. You had many different kinds of velvet. Velvet that would be interwoven with, you know, gold or silver thread. Velvet that would be voided to create patterns. Velvet that would be cut in different pile lengths to give different kinds of sheen on it. I mean, it was extraordinary. I could have written a book just about velvet. So you had all these differences, and each one of them had a different value in terms of their cost. So I spent a lot of time with a calculator calculating Roman numerals back into kind of arithmetic additions to see what I could make of them.
Well, that's the one of the threads, I guess. I don't mean that, but I can't avoid it. It's the best word. One of the threads that carries through the whole book is the value of textiles in that time, to the point where almost more valuable than, you know, coins and paper money.
And of the same value as armor and, you know, and other things. I mean, it is extraordinary to think that at that point in the Renaissance, late Renaissance, we're talking about, textiles were carried the spirit of the age, and they were the scripts, the visual scripts of power and status and wealth. And any interior in a court or a chateau or whatever would be completely festooned in fabric, be that as embroidered carpets, as wall hangings, as bed hangings. Even a bed itself had numerous components to it. So it would have top valances, bottom valances, bed covers, pillows, foot mantles, a whole range of textiles. And each one of those, each single one of those would be embroidered. And that's without even the woven tapestries and other things that were there. There was all the heraldic imagery that was used for tournaments. I mean, it was just a wash with textiles, as I say, as the script of their odors, yeah, to tell their lives, their lineage, and their power.
I know when my children were young, I homeschooled them, and we heard about Henry VIII and the cloth of gold. You know, it was kind of in the story, and it was just like, yes, and there was these elaborate textiles there, and that was it. It was just like, that was the blurb, and you move on. But you describe that so well in the book, how much time that took, and I think people sewing at the last, you know, doing the embroidery at the last minute, how many they employed. And I think we forget that in our modern world. It just, every time I read that, it hits me again, you know, how we don't pay much attention to how textiles, but for them, how important it was to signify who you were and where you came from. I found that fascinating.
And also, I think, Beth, it was a much more sensual age. So in terms of not just the content of those textiles, but the sensuality of those textiles, the feel, you know, people had much more sensitivity to the feel of cloth and the way it moved, the flow of cloth. And you can see that from how their fashion developed, that they'd have this strong central core that was corseted. And then out of that, from that, they would have the flow of a gown or the swish of a cape or the waterfall of a veil. So they used cloth in a very different way than we use it today, not just to dress themselves, but to animate themselves and animate their surroundings. I was fascinated when I was researching about what light meant to people in the Renaissance. You know, there they were using, in the main, candlelight, and then as glass became more available, daylight through glass. And they used all these metallic threads and silk thread and Jules was on textiles in order to let light bounce around a room, bounce from person to person. So they were very engaged with how you used that light on their textiles. The velvets that were woven with silver and gold were woven with those to then create this underlying flicker of gleam. You know, they were so sensitive to that, those ideas of the visual and the tactile idea of cloth.
Right. And I can see why you'd want to, you could almost write a book on velvet, because it, you know, depending on how it moves, even the velvet we have now, you know, it gives a shimmer, it gives a shine.
Absolutely.
And so if they had more velvet than what we have available today, that would be fascinating.
Yes, and lots of different kinds of velvet. And I love the idea that actually the court tailors were most prized for their expertise in cutting, because obviously, you know, when they were creating garments that were made out of different pieces, then the way you cut velvet is very important in order to keep a kind of, you know, to not let the light that falls upon it be distorted. And right. To try and create what appears like a whole garment from these pieces. And as we know with velvet, depending on the way the light goes, then it changes its shade.
Yes.
That was fascinating. Fascinating.
Is the in your trips to museums, I mean, the clothing, that's the thing that we forget, is the clothing that was made back in those times was made to last and last a long time and be handed down and yes. And so on and so forth. I assume that the sewing part, the construction, everything was just the epitome of perfection.
Absolutely. You know, it was double seamed for strength, as you say, Guy, in order that it could last and it could be robust. It was lined, again, sometimes with the linings giving another kind of underlying message. So you might have fur that was lined with silk to give these different textures, etc. But sadly, robustly, though it was made, you know, 500 years, it can't last that long. so there's very little of 16th century costume that it survives, particularly in Britain. And that is, you know, partly because it did get reused and reused because it was so expensive. Then it was rarely discarded. It was recycled and reused and remade into other things and continued to have use over, you know, decades, centuries sometimes. But by the time we get to our century, then very little has survived intact.
Yeah.
They did discover in England recently what was in a church in a small place called Bacton, which a fantastic curator recognised as possibly a skirt of Elizabeth I of England. And none of her clothing, her extensive wardrobe, 2,000 gowns said to have been left when she died, but none of that survives. But actually it turned out that the skirt was, which they could tell through portraits, was an original skirt that Elizabeth had worn that had been changed into an altar hanging. Now, when the curators rescued that piece from the church and then unpicked it, then the colour on its underside was as bright as it had been in its day. And that was a revelation, because obviously it had greyed everything, if you know, in its outer appearance, then it was grey, blue, a little bit of kind of dull yellow. On its underside, it's a riot, an absolute riot of colour. You can see it on YouTube, Elizabeth I's skirt. It's fantastic to see what that looked like. And then you get an insight into what kind of colours were around the, you know, people in the Renaissance, the vibrancy of that colour and the detail of their embroidery. It is astonishing. It is fantastic, actually.
So as you just, yeah, because we, yeah, when we see old stuff these days, it's usually dingy, gray, dirty, whatever, and, yeah, and you this. Have no appreciation for the color. But as you describe all of this, my mind is picturing how at a banquet or whatever event, how you really showed your wealth, if you were into that, just through the fabrics.
Absolutely. And if you can imagine being at a court environment with, you know, dancing courtiers in that, as I say, that kind of medley of colour and jewellery and gilt thread and the tapestries on the walls, again, interwoven with gold thread, candlelight flickering all over it. I mean, it must have been a kind of enchanted world, really.
I would think so, yeah. Talk about seeing Mary's embroideries. What were your reactions? Because for me, it's, you know, what was she did, you know, an incredible amount of needlework. Was it quality needlework? Was it just an expression? What was your reaction when you saw her work?
Well, I've seen her work in different ways. So I saw it a few years ago at Oxburgh Hall in Norfolk, and again at Hardwick Hall in Derbyshire, where the embroideries are behind glass, so you don't get such a direct feeling for them. But when I went to the Palace of Holyrood House in Edinburgh, then they were, the creators there were very kind and brought out a couple of the embroideries that they have out of their glass case. And I couldn't touch them, but I could put my nose inches away from them. And what was really interesting to me was partly that they revealed, which I hoped that they might do, Mary's temperament when she was sewing. So you've got a sense of her, you know, sewing evenly and smoothly for a while, and then basically it becomes uneven. Her stitching grumbles along for a bit, and then she finds her rhythm again. Her stitching was very basic. Her stitching was just, you know, petit point, so it was using kind of cross stitch and, you know, and a couple of other basic stitches. But what it was obsessive. When I looked at particularly an embroidery called A Cat that she did, which is a political piece in a sense, in that she took a woodcut from Conrad Gesner, who'd published books about flora and fauna at that time. She took a black and white woodcut of his, and then she basically reimagined it in colour, making the cat that she was showing a red cat to personify the red-haired Elizabeth I, who she hoped might have been a soulmate, but who became an adversary. And then she inserted alongside the cat, which isn't in Conrad's Gerstner's original, a little mouse with the cat's paw treading on its tail so that it can't move. So it became a piece about capture. And when I actually then, you know, I had an image of that. When I blew it up, I then counted the stitches that she had on that, just that one piece. And there were, I would say, over 10,000 stitches in that one piece alone. Now, when she died, when she was executed, there were 300, some done, some unfinished pieces of embroidery. The pieces of her embroidery, which are autographed by Mary, be that by her cipher or by thistles or by the Crown of Scotland, there's about 30 of them. And we know there would have been a lot more. So we're talking about a woman who spent so much time, so much labour, that you can only think of it as a crusade to set down her own testimony when her letters were being censored and visitors were monitored. So with her embroidery, I think it was partly a solace. And we know in terms of mental health, and Mary's mental health was fragile, in terms of mental health, how much of a salve sewing can be because of its rhythm, because of it being allowing you to have a sense of your inner self as you sew along, and you can ruminate on your life. But also it was a mission for Mary to set down her story.
Yeah. Well, that was the, in reading this book, it took me back to your first book, with so many situations where needlework basically kept people from losing their minds
in
difficult situations. And Mary's life was a difficult situation from day one. So you can see, you know, that's interesting to hear you describe that, because it kind of fills in a hole for me about how needlework just kept her from going crazy, you know, to put it in just most basic terms, because she had to be at the edge so many times.
Absolutely. And I love the idea, Guy, that in her stitches, when I saw that piece embroidery cat at the Palace of Holyrood House, then basically it has trapped her experience and her emotion. So the fact that the stitches aren't even actually, in an odd way, documents and is evidence of her agitation and her mental distress at times. Had it been a perfect piece of embroidery, had it been something that felt totally calm, you wouldn't have had such an insight into her sense and into her emotional experience at that point. And it is remarkable that, as I say, 500 years on, we can read somebody's mental state through something they have left behind.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was the thing. I think I even commented to Beth, but certainly in my mind, when you take someone, take Mary, hauled to France as a child, literally a child, and brought up in that environment, and then back to Scotland, a completely different environment, still as a very young lady, and then expected to lead a country and expected to understand the culture and the expectations and the history when she grew up in the Renaissance and in the lap of luxury. The psychological part of that, and I was anxious to get your sense of that overall psychological situation or status or whatever of Mary. You know, what sense did you get of just, I can't even imagine being torn that many different ways?
Well, I think that, you know, we all know, you know, if you have early trauma, as Mary did, I mean, her first 5 years, Scotland was living, in a sense, in war with England. So it was constantly being besieged in battle terms. And she was being, you know, kept in high security for fear that she would be abducted by the English and forced to marry the son of Henry VIII, Edward. So she lived her first 5 years in a state of, well, would terror be too small a word, you know, too extravagant to use in that sense. And then when she was five, her father dead, when she was just, you know, a few days old, she was then sent off to France, left her mother, left Scotland, left all the familiar sights and sounds and smells of her childhood, and to go unknown into a different country whose language she did not speak. And then she was immersed in the French court culture. Luckily, in France, she did have family. She had her Guise aunts and uncles and grandparents. And so probably for Mary at that stage, it felt like a haven compared to the turmoil and the security that she'd had to experience until the age of five in Scotland. So then she lived in France. She eventually marries a Dauphin. She becomes Queen of France when Francois I dies, and the Dauphin becomes Francois II. And then just, you know, within a year of marriage, she's widowed. And suddenly she's again kind of adrift, totally adrift. Catherine de' Medici, her mother-in-law, didn't want her in France. And she was, and didn't want her marrying anybody else in Europe who might become a threat to the French power. And so she came back to Scotland. But Scotland was in such a time of change and turmoil itself, partly because of the Reformation, where it had just recently, just months before Mary had arrived back in its shores, had become Protestant. She was still a Catholic and a vehement Catholic. It was what had shaped her in her time in France. And also she had nobody there who was kin, who was family.
Yeah.
And she was a woman at a time when there was a major debate going on throughout Europe about the capacity of women and the right of women to rule. So in those sense, she came back to a culture that was very dominantly a male culture, where women were treated with suspicion and were given her Catholicism, and also the fact that she was shaped by France, both were, again, marks against her. So she met there with, ultimately, with distrust and then betrayal.
Yeah. Well, Beth, you had brought up about Dauphin and imagining, raised with him as good friends.
Yes.
That really struck you, Beth.
Right, and the fact that, here she is. Okay, she's lost her friend along with her spouse, and then that's got to be traumatic in and of itself. And then to be forced to move, I think the trauma there.
Absolutely, and she lost someone who loved her.
Right.
She the year before she'd lost her mother, but the Dauphin loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she lost him.
Yeah.
So she had nobody who loved her. Apart from her gay family, of course. But when she came back to Scotland, they weren't there.
Right.
And she had to try to forge new alliances. And she was only 18.
Yeah, that's the part we have to keep in mind. She's 18 and she's already been through all of this. Yes.
Absolutely. She's only 18 and her four maids around her are 18 or 17. They're younger. They're all young girls who've been in France for the last 13 years. And then they come back to Scotland. And one also has to think about, they come back to Scotland that isn't the balmy summers of French, whatever. Scotland is atrocious. It's going through kind of, it's in the midst of what was called the Third Ice Age. It's the winters are horrific. They are, just so harsh. And so she's coming back into not just a political climate, and the emotional climate, but into a physical climate that is adversarial.
Right. Yeah. And I think of John of Knox, and he is so anti-female, in a lot of ways. It's kind of interesting. And then here she is, this female Catholic leader, and that they are going to butt heads. And but she's by herself and she's only 18, and to have to defend herself against this learned man and stand up to him, that must have been terribly difficult.
Oh, yes. He brought her to tears. John Knox was, somebody, absolutely cleaved to his Calvinistic beliefs. And you can honor him for that. He had his faith and he believed it was the right faith to follow. But Mary, when she came back to Scotland, there was agreement with her half-brother that she would be allowed to continue hearing Mass just in the churches, in the chapels at court. But Knox was appalled at that license, that she should be allowed, that Mass should be in any shape or form continue in the kingdom. And he deplored all the manifestations of femininity in terms of fashion and clothes and entertainments that had been there in Mary's father's time and in her grandfather's time. She didn't invent these things. These were already part of court life. But she came in for such vitriol from him because he was trying to forge a Scotland on a new aesthetic that was simple, that was unglamorous, and that was, in a sense, very severe, because that, he felt, was a better way to God. And all that Mary came with went against everything that he hoped would happen. And so he was her enemy in that sense.
Yeah, she was color and brightness and events and dances and music and yes, all those things.
I love the quote that I have in the book, which is, you know, basically he was, you know, just totally, you know, found her skipping down the corridors of the court, abhorrent, you know, women skipping, you know, how dare they? And so you've got that contrast, haven't you, between these young girls, young posse of young girls, you know, dancing and skipping and playing with dolls and doing all sorts of things that were just against his idea of, or basically bore out his idea of frivolous women, whereas actually they weren't frivolous. Mary wasn't frivolous. She had been brought up to be a queen. She had been educated to be a queen. She was extremely highly educated. You know, was a multilinguist, had read all the classics, and had been inducted into into politics and to how to be a leader. Yeah. So she wasn't in that sense politically naive, but she had so much that went against her.
Men. Oh, men. And we've learned zero. We've learned zero in all these years, you know?
500, Gary.
I know. I'm just pointing at 500. Nothing. Nothing. We've learned nothing.
And since we're talking about Mary's psychological state, I mean, what about her relationship with her son? You know, okay, you know, later, I'm skipping ahead, she's separated from her son. And how did that affect her emotionally? I can't imagine that.
Well, you can't imagine, can you? I mean, there she was. The last time she saw him, he was 10 months old. And then she, because she her nobles rose against her, and she remarried against their choice. And so ultimately they went to battle. She was defeated and she fled to England. And there are piteous letters from her to Elizabeth I that she wrote when she was in England, because she wasn't allowed to even be in correspondence with them. And her son was being brought up by her enemies. Her son was being brought up by Protestants, yes, but also those who believed that Mary was both an adulteress in terms of her third marriage, which they felt had... She'd married, having already embarked on an adulterous affair with Lord Bothwell. And they also thought that Lord Bothwell and herself had conspired to murder her second husband, Lord Darnley. So James, who became James VI of Scotland and I of England, was brought up believing and being told that his mother was a murderer and an adulterer. And his tutor, George Buchanan, who was a stern Latin scholar, had, although he had originally been friendly with Mary and had tutored her in the writings of Livy, etc., became one of her key opponents. And so he was brought up in a poisonous atmosphere in terms of his mother's reputation. And Mary then lost any access to him until he'd reached his majority. What she did, however, was she started to embroider a set of bed hangings, which no longer survive, but there is a detailed description of them. And she used her sewing to tell James her story, both the story of who she belonged to in terms of dynastic connections that she and therefore him had through life, but also to tell of her decline, of her destruction of her power, and of her conflicted relationship with Elizabeth. So at least she would leave him her true story, which I find very moving. And he did inherit those bed hangings. They were left to him in Mary's will. And she told her one of her household that he was to deliver them personally to the Scottish court, so they weren't destroyed and that they survived, and James VI. And he did change his attitude towards his mother. And after she was executed and had been buried in Peterborough Cathedral, he then demanded that she be her body be reinterred and put in Westminster Abbey along with Elizabeth I. So he did, in the end, try to honour her. But he, of course, was himself damaged by that lack of relationship and by being brought up to believe something different from what he ultimately thought was true. He was brought up without a mother. He was brought up in the shadow of her being this evil figure, as she was promulgated to be in Scotland, and that he was the son. And not only that, there was at points rumours that he was not the son of Lord Darnley, Mary's second husband, but the son of an affair between Mary and David Rizzio, her Italian secretary. So there was a slight stain of possible illegitimacy that surrounded him. So he had a very damaged childhood as well.
The way they manipulated people all through this thing, it's just, it just makes you sick the way age has nothing to do with it. You know, little kids, and they just manipulate and use them for their own gain. It's, what a world. Okay, we're gonna do a Claire Hunter, and we're gonna get away from the sad, dark stuff, and go to something lighter. So this is the Claire Hunter technique live in action right here. Beth and I both commented the dolls, the way dolls were used for fashion. What a fascinating story you tell there.
Isn't it fascinating? It was the historian, Scottish historian Michael Pearce, who unearthed that gem. Basically, he was the person who, you know, in the inventories of the belongings Mary left behind when she fled Scotland, there's mention of pippinas, which is usually translated as puppets. Now, puppetry was around at that time, but actually he then found, again, in other inventories, references to Mary's tailor being given very expensive fabric to make into dolls' clothes and presumably costumes. And this led him to suggest that Mary and her ladies-in-waiting used dolls to both... as fashion dolls, you know, to get information about what fashions were around, which was a kind of in the culture at that time, but also, and really interestingly, that they used them to rehearse their own public performances at masks or in processions, etc., by, you know, using these dolls to stand in for themselves. Now, fashion dolls, this was before the time of fashion plates, and because Renaissance fashion was so important in its detail, then it was much easier for tailors, court tailors, to make up replica dolls that showed the number of pleats in a skirt, showed the actual fabric that people were wearing, showed the trimmings and how they were set off with those, etc., and then to send them across borders to other continents so that people elsewhere could keep up with the fashions of the time. And sometimes it might be a husband-to-be would send them to a prospective wife so they could prepare their trousseau for the court that they were going to enter. Sometimes, very, again, fascinatingly, they were used between women as a source of support and comfort. So, for instance, Catherine de' Medici, who we think of her as the, or she's reputed to be the kind of poisoner queen, you know, the evil one. But actually, she, after the death of her husband, Francois II, she had some of her dolls dressed in mourning clothes, so they would be her small companions in grief. But also when Elizabeth I lost a French tutor who died, one of the tutors that she had, Catherine de' Medici sent Elizabeth I a little doll in mourning gown as a kind of a salve of comfort and shared mourning at that time. So this idea that dolls, they weren't only just for fashion, but they were also a form of exchange between women, emotional exchange between women and a form of support, I think is really, really interesting.
Yeah, it filled in a huge hole for me in turn, you know, just in growing up, and you know, you see these dolls from time to time that you know, you can buy very expensive dolls with very elaborate clothing, all made just like an adult would wear or a girl would wear, and I've never understood why people would go to that much trouble for a doll. And then when I read this, it filled that in. That's a, you know, just a carrying on of this practice of using dolls to communicate fashion.
Yes, and to create fashion. as a wee girl, I used to yearn. There was a doll maker called Peggy Nisbet who did a whole kind of cavalcade of historical dolls. And they came in boxes with cellophane covers that you could see the doll through, and they were always in shop windows, and they were very expensive. And and so I could never afford one, but I yearned for them. And it's part of my kind of research for Mary Queen of Scots as my talisman. I got on eBay Peggy Nisbet, Mary Queen of Scots doll, who stood beside me as I wrote.
Well, and like you're saying, even now, I know someone who that's what she does. She sews these fashion clothes, and it is for women, you know, older women to dress these dolls. But there's something about it. It you know, to change their clothes, to exchange them.
Yes.
There's a whole network of them.
Yes.
Say it was just interesting to me too that they handed them down, and then they did portraits. You'd see these young girls, and I always wondered about these portraits of girls, and they would have these fashion dolls. And yes. I just wondered where they came from.
And as you say, Beth, online now, I mean, you can, you know, I looked it up and I don't talk about it in the book, but there's lots and lots and lots of societies about dolls who are exchanging information about dolls, collecting dolls, you know, some of them are themed, you know, et cetera. It's a whole fascinating area.
Beth, you really got locked in on Bess of Hardwick.
I knew who she was. I'd heard a little bit about her, and Gay Ann Rogers had a little heart or a little portrait of her. And I was like, okay, so who is, I knew she was like the guardian of Mary, Queen of Scots, and that she was a friend of Elizabeth I. And that was the extent of my knowledge. And I was, so your book just opened up that world. Here's this woman who was, in my mind, a powerful businesswoman. Mm. I mean, in her own right.
Yes.
And so unusual in that time.
Yes. And, you know, the thing with Bess was that in her time, she was then seen as ambitious, which was seen as a flaw in a woman. But actually, she was an entrepreneur, somebody who was culturally inquisitive and ambitious on all sorts of different levels. You know, and when she took on with her husband the guardianship of Mary, I think for Mary, you know, after, you know, what had been a terrible time being imprisoned in Lochleven and then being defeated in battle, fleeing to England, not having around her people of, you know, well, not having women around her particularly except for her women in waiting, then Bess must have been like a burst of fresh air. Although she was nearly 20 years older than Mary, she was spirited. She was probably great company. I'm sure she was, you know, she was energetic and she was lively, and she wasn't trammelled by political status or by queenship. She was just a woman who had made her way in her life and had done so very successfully. And for Mary, it must have been liberation at the start.
Yeah, they spent a tremendous amount of time together, but then fell out, got that broke
they
down.
They fell out. They fell out, Gary, as women do, sadly.
So, once again, we learn nothing. We just learn nothing.
We learn nothing, exactly. So basically, I think they were forced into such close proximity in such hard circumstances. And again, for Bess, it must have been really, really difficult because she was a guardian of Mary and they had to keep an eye on her at all times and report on all her activities. Then she couldn't go for wee sojourns to the English court and have a bit of kind of relaxation and gossip and delight in other company. And also it meant that, you know, instead of it just being her, and what was her recent new husband, the Earl of Shrewsbury, it then became three. It became her, the Earl of Shrewsbury, and Mary. And so, you know, they were part of a triangle. And in later years, she then began to suspect that the Earl was having an affair with Mary, which I'm sure is totally untrue. But you can understand her paranoia that he was so solicitous for Mary, and she felt that she was maybe, you know, that his love for her was waning, and so she became jealous, and Mary also, you know, basically there was the falling out, and acrimonious falling out with Bess and Mary both turning to Elizabeth I to give bad reports of each other, etc., etc. It all ended in tears.
Yeah. What an incredible burden Elizabeth put on the Shrewsburys to imprison her there.
Absolutely. And imprison her there on just a small amount of, well, not small in some terms, but small in terms of what they had to then look after. So they were constantly, the Earl of Shrewsbury was beside himself with anxiety, trying to unlock money after money after monies after monies after money to pay for the 100-strong guard that she had to have, all the every place that she moved to. And she moved in 19 years that she was in imprisonment in England, she was moved over 4 to 6 times. Each of those places had to be decked out in the right kind of furnishings for a queen. It wasn't an easy task. And the kind of machinations or the logistics involved in setting up the furniture, the bedding, the staff, the security, etc., was a nightmare, a total nightmare. And they had to do it over and over and over again. And the constant letters from him asking for basically, you know, payment of of monies that are late, payments of money that haven't yet been agreed, for extra assistance, most of which was ignored because he was very rich. And Elizabeth I thought, well, actually, he can bear the burden, you know, not of all of it. And Mary refused to pay anything out of her own dowry income revenue because she was there against her will. So why should she pay for, you know, her captivity? So it was a huge strain, not just emotionally on Bess and the Earl of Shrewsbury as a couple, but financially and just in terms of the responsibility they had. And every time another chink in the security was discovered, they, of course, were held culpable. Right. And they were constantly in danger of being, you know, in those days, anybody who was least bit tarnished with an idea of treason basically got executed. So they did live in fear of their lives, I'm sure, at times. The strain must have been enormous.
And Mary was charming. I mean, she was. So I can see why Bess of Hardwick was kind of like, okay, you've got this young lady who's known to be charming. So the jealousy's, I mean, got to be there. And then the strain of the Shrewsbury to balance between Mary, who's a queen, and then Elizabeth, who's a queen. And
well, and also they didn't know whether Mary and the various plots that went on, not often with her agreement, but plots that went on to free her and basically overthrow Elizabeth, whether Mary might become queen.
Right.
So they had to play a double, you know, a double game in both keeping sweet with Elizabeth, but also keeping sweet with Mary. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so that must have been hard. You know?
Well, and that Mary, she was crafty at communicating. Holy smokes. She got messages out all kinds of ways. That was fun.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. What, of course, now we got to wrap up here. Doggone it. What was your overall, after all the research and everything, what was your overall impression of the dynamics between Mary and Elizabeth?
Well, I think the dynamics between the two of them was a difficult one because it was too stranded, because there was the personal dynamic and there was the political dynamic. Mary very much wanted Elizabeth to be the soulmate she didn't have. She was a queen like Elizabeth. She had had in different ways, but had also experienced a traumatic childhood like Mary had. She had lost her parents. She was an orphan, as Mary was. And apart from their religious difference, they were similarly educated. They both embroidered. They shared a woman's culture. And I think Mary very much hoped that in Elizabeth, as I say, she had found her soulmate. But Elizabeth also, I think, had a huge sympathy and empathy for Mary, but could not allow herself to express or practice that because of the warnings by her male advisers, particularly William Cecil. And so because her grasp on the throne was, in a sense, tentative, because she was a Protestant, then her as queen was not recognised by the Catholic Church in Europe, and she was seen to be an illegitimate queen. And also because she was the daughter of Anne Boleyn, who'd been executed by Henry VIII. And so in that sense, she'd been, at that point, she'd been taken out of the succession line, although she did regain it. So she was in a delicate situation politically as a queen herself, and she couldn't actually risk any kind of chink in her particular political armour. And so she then kowtowed to her male advisers and stayed on the political fence as regards Mary. But there's no doubt in my mind that she cared for her, and had they been other women in another time, in different kinds of courts, they would have been support to each other.
Yeah, you get that sense all the way through that she's just one little moment, one weak moment, and she would have Mary's back covered in a heartbeat. And,
yes.
But just couldn't do it. Yeah.
Couldn't do it, exactly. Just was constantly warned off it.
Yeah. Oh, these right. Women just lived lives on the knife edge. Oh, geez. All right, we got to stop. Darn it. We got to stop. Claire, thanks so much. Thanks for doing the book. Folks, go buy the book, Embroidering Her Truth, Mary, Queen of Scots, and the Language of Power, and get Threads of Life, A History of the World Through the Eye of a Needle while you're doing it, and then just sit down and read for days. You'll love it.
Yeah.
Claire, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, listen, Beth and Gary, thank you. It's lovely talking to you again. And thank you for supporting me and the book. It's very kind of you.
Yeah, hurry up and write another one so we can talk again, will you?
There's meant to be a third one. What that's going to be about, I have no idea at this point.
Okay, well, we'll wait for it. All right, thanks everyone for
listening.
All right, thank you. Thank you again.